My name is Stuart J. Brown. I'm professor of ecclesiastical history and vice convener of the Gifford Lectureships Committee. I'm honored to introduce our Gifford lecturer, the eminent theologian and public intellectual, Professor Michael Welker, senior professor at the University of Heidelberg and director of the Research Center for International and Interdisciplinary Theology. His Gifford series is entitled In God's Image, Anthropology, and it is illuminating the human potential for justice, freedom, truth, and peace in a troubled world that too often denigrates such potential. In his first lecture yesterday, Professor Welker introduced the themes that he will be exploring in his series, including the fundamental question of whether, and if so, in what ways, human beings can be understood as formed in the image of God. While belief that humans reflect the image of God is held by many faith traditions, Professor Welker noted how such a belief can be hard to sustain amid political manipulations and ideologies of hatred. He observed how cultural and social realities, including the darkness of 20th century totalitarian regimes, can point to a very different vision of the nature and destiny of humankind. But his lecture also affirmed the potential of the human spirit to look, in Immanuel Kant's words, to the starry skies above and the moral law within. And in this potential, there is hope. Please note that the lecture and the questions this evening are being recorded, and the video will shortly be available online on the university's Gifford Lectureship web pages. Professor Welker, it's a great pleasure now to invite you to present your second Gifford lecture, The Human Spirit and the Divine Spirit.
Thank you, Jay, for your very kind introduction. This lecture will first unfold a natural theology of the divine spirit by means of a contemporary example. What one finds is that a purely intellectual, rational understanding of this spirit, or vague notions that it is a numinous entity that eludes our understanding, cannot adequately grasp the spirit and its workings. In the second part, I demonstrate how the divine spirit and the human spirit are multimodal powers that cannot be reduced to entities characterized predominantly by bipolar relations. Observations on early childhood mental development in the third part show that the human mind is considerably broader and more complex than the intellectual rational spirit. Aesthetic and moral powers in coordination with the human body and its natural and social environments must be included to get a full picture of the human spirit. In the final part, I broaden the perspective on social, political, and religious questions connected to the spirit by turning to a mastermind of the spirit, the philosopher Hegel. Even in his early years, he was interested in a natural theology of the human spirit and the divine spirit. In a multimodal fashion, he developed a theological and moral concept of these spirits that ultimately focuses on freedom and justice. Later, his philosophy turned to metaphysical and totalitarian notions of the spirit that, however, cannot but compromise the spirit of freedom. So let me start a contemporary natural theology of the divine spirit. In October 1978, Karl Wojtyla from Poland was elected Pope. 8 months later, in June 1979, during the second of his over 100 trips abroad, he visited his homeland and celebrated his first Mass there on Victory Square in Warsaw. He concluded with a prayer that electrified his fellow Poles. I quote him. "And I cry, I, who am a son of the land of Poland, and who am also Pope John Paul II, I cry from all the depths of this millennium, I cry on the vigil of Pentecost, let your spirit descend. Let your spirit descend and renew the face of the earth, the face of this land. Amen." Everyone in Poland understood what he said, except perhaps the communist government, which allegedly wondered whom exactly had summoned, the CIA. A year later, in 1980, strikes erupted in the country, leading to the founding of the labor union Solidarity, and despite numerous violent attacks, setbacks, to social, political, and freedom-based transformations in Poland and elsewhere. 2 decades later, during his 8th penultimate journey to Poland, John Paul II spoke once more at the site of his legendary 1979 address. I quote him again. "Is not all that happened at that time in Europe and the world, beginning with our homeland, God's response? Before our eyes, changes of political, social, and economic systems have taken place, enabling individuals, nations, to see anew the splendor of their own dignity. Truth and justice are recovering their proper value, becoming a challenge for all those who are able to appreciate the gift of freedom." Justice, truth, freedom, as mentioned in this speech, along with peace and love, are themes that consistently stir the hearts of people in many cultures. They are also central themes in the Bible. Indeed, Paul in the New Testament, along with other biblical traditions, explicitly associate these concepts with the activities of the Holy Spirit. In the Old Testament, the classical biblical witness to the outpouring of the divine spirit is the prophet Joel. And in the New Testament, it is Acts chapter 2. It is highly noteworthy that biblical accounts of the outpouring of the spirit explicitly include women and even maidservants, female slaves, and young people, that is, not merely the men who traditionally had the last word in such communities. The New Testament account in Acts, moreover, also mentions the salutary effects that the outpouring of the Spirit had on numerous other nations, races, and languages. The Pope does not address the highly charged and even revolutionary consequences that these biblical witnesses have for the status and treatment of women and against the subordination of young people in patriarchal and gerontocratic communities, not to speak of chauvinistic, xenophobic, and racist environments. But for the moment, let us concentrate on the notion itself of the outpouring of the Spirit. This phenomenon implies that the divine Spirit can be invoked, that is, petitioned to descend upon human beings, but also those receiving this outpouring are in their own then turn summoned to respond in life-changing ways. The outpouring of the Spirit is a realistic event. that within the context of natural theology can be conveyed particularly by the way of its effects on human circumstances. For John Paul II also spoke about social, political, economic, and moral transformations, with tangible changes for individual persons, an entire nation, and even international relations. And to describe the weave of virtues and values he discerned being mediated by the Spirit, he turned to the grand concepts of truth, justice, freedom, and human dignity. He considered this development to be God's response to the petitionary invocation associated with the liturgical event. At the same time, he was clearly aware that these social and political developments were also the fruits of his summons to the people of Poland and to many other supportive powers throughout the world, something many of his addresses during the journeys to Poland underscore. The summons, however, is intimately associated with an invocation of the Spirit, or more precisely, these remarkable developments were in fact brought about by the countless committed engagements that followed upon the invocation and summons. How might we understand more clearly the cooperative actions of the divine Spirit and the human Spirit in this light? Second part, the Spirit, a multimodal and multipolar power. The expression multimodal has been in common use only since the 20th century, particularly since the digital revolution and primarily in connection with linguistics, media studies, psychology, philosophy, and economics. In business communication, multimodality can, for example, enhance customer satisfaction by providing several contact possibilities between customers and the business, such as text messaging, chats, and social media. Media are multimodal if, for example, they deliver information not just by way of a single medium, such as a text, but throughout other media as well, such as speech and images, that not only specify a message more clearly, but also actually shape it. By contrast, one speaks of multipolar constellations whenever a given constellation of people, social entities, or even an arrangement of nerve cells possesses several centers and several poles. The idea of a multipolar world order, for example, envisions a political engagement with several power centers, enabling the world to be stabilized or destabilized by different states or power blocks. But why is this present inquiry concerning the human spirit and the divine spirit and their cooperative activities, why might this profit from a multimodal and multipolar approach? The advantage of understanding the spirit by way of such an approach is that it offers wholly new insights over against dominant forms of the traditional understanding of the Spirit. To wit, previous perspectives on the Spirit and its effects were distorted by, among other things, attempt to come to an understanding by way of culturally tenaciously rooted bipolar thinking. The notion of the Spirit and its effects tended to be reduced to simple relationships. God, person, human being, fellow human being, my interior intellectual, moral, and religious dialogue, the relationship between the act of thinking and what is thought, and so on. In situations in which one sensed that the spirit was somehow more than could be articulated by bipolar reductions, the remedy in many religious and even secular communities was simply to view it as a mysterious, nebulous, incomprehensible, numinous power. One shifts, as it were, from unequivocal bipolarity over to a diffuse plurality and assumes that the divine spirit is a numinous, transcendent power that descends upon creatures from the beyond like wind and rain. The figure of the outpouring of the Spirit from above, conceived in a less than rigorous manner, in various biblical statements, seemed to support such vague notions. A reflection on John Paul's II invocation and summoning of the Spirit in Warsaw in 1979, however, provides us with a considerably different perspective. Although the Pope was convinced that God did indeed respond to the invocation, that response did not come about in some ghost-like, indeterminate fashion. Instead, a large number of people was concretely, profoundly moved and inspired to think, communicate, and act anew, and indeed in new ways. In the historical case under consideration here, a considerable role was played by a distinct consciousness, not only of divine power, but also of open support by the head of the Roman Catholic Church. A key factor in all situations involving the outpouring of the Spirit, however, both past and present, is that the resulting interplay between people does not simply remain diffuse and aimless. What emerges is a focused movement. A great many individuals act together, doubtless sometimes even in conflict with one another, and yet always in reaction to one another, and it is together collectively that their actions bring about grand results. Plural developments of this sort, developments that cannot be traced back to simple cause and effect chains, are described as emergent. As a rule, emergent developments initiated by the outpouring of the Spirit cannot be guided or stopped by simple interventions and are permeated by a healthy measure of free decisions and actions, and thus sometimes take surprising turns. It is extremely important to keep in mind that these developments always focus on specific content, for the Divine Spirit does not impart this or that arbitrary impulse. Although even influential thinkers such as Hans Küng or Charles Taylor have repeatedly asserted that people need, I quote, some kind of religiously and morally imparted orientation, this view ignores the important notion of a discernment of spirits. After all, there are not only freedom-oriented spirits, but also evil, destructive, and subversive spirits. Think of an evil spirit that spreads hate in a country. The view that a spirit and its effects are from the outset exclusively good is as naive and foolish, I use the strong word, as the view that morality and religion are always and in all their manifestations charitable and good. Here the differentiation between the divine spirit, which is always conducive to life, and other spirits, whose effects can be good or evil, is essential. Recently, and not least under the impression of global ecological self-endangerment, we have heard the assertion that the divine spirit must be understood as the spirit of life. And indeed, historically, the terms nature and life have frequently been used with salvific connotations. Unfortunately, a great many illusory concepts associated with spirit and life also came into circulation as a result of this understanding. For if the spirit brings about life in what is essentially an unqualified manner, it also promotes the growth of tumor cells or the sudden emergence and development of a reign of terror. Because nature and life are ambivalent concepts, they are ill-suited for understanding the divine spirit without qualification. After all natural earthly life, without exception, lives indispensably at the cost of other life. Thus the formulation of Alfred North Whitehead, life is robbery. And I quote from Whitehead's Gifford Lectures, Process and Reality, An Essay in Cosmology, 1927-28. And Whitehead says, thus all societies, and he understands us, human beings, as societies, because he understands us as an interplay of many organs and members and so on. So we are a society. But we have also, of course, larger societies. But all societies, he says, require interplay with their environment. And in the case of living societies, this interplay takes the form of robbery. The living society may or may not be a higher type of organism than the food which it disintegrates. But whether or no it be for the general good, life is robbery. It is at this point that with life, morals become acute. The robber requires justification. End of quote. Precisely this insight prompted the Apostle Paul to emphasize the dualism between the flesh and the spirit. The fleshly, biological existence of human beings is unavoidably predatory and frequently sustained by illusions. For it not only lives at the cost of other life, but also believes itself normally capable of doing so for an indefinite period of time through fleshly activities such as eating and propagation. Paul's radical criticism of fleshly existence has frequently offended people, me too for a long time, who accuse him of promoting views hostile to the body, to sexuality, and to homosexuality. Such objections fail to see, however, that Paul is in fact making an extremely important distinction, namely between flesh and body. For the human body is characterized not only by transitory, predatory flesh, but also by psyche, soul, and spirit. Indeed, the body is a fascinating entity precisely because of the multiplicity of its constituent parts, their interplay, their mutual sensitivity, and their multifarious radiation. It can both be viewed as the temple of the Holy Spirit, 1 Corinthians 6, and adduced as an orienting image for the existence of free spiritual communities. I will come back to this fascinating topic in my lecture on truth. The petitioning of the divine spirit and the summons to allow oneself to be seized and filled by the spirit are thus not counting on nature as such, as an indistinct powers of life, or on indistinct powers of life. They focus rather on life's qualified creative powers. John Paul II, undoubtedly inspired by Paul, spoke about the powers of justice, freedom, and truth, as well as about human dignity. Indeed, this emphasis on universal human dignity erects, as it were, a kind of protective sphere around each and every human being. And in doing so, precludes any view of individual human life, for example, in the face of massive global overpopulation, as being superfluous and harmful in and of itself. Vehement debates today about the international obligation to accept refugees or rescue them from distress at sea vividly illustrate the highly charged nature of this topic. People overcome and seized by the spirit constitute, on the one hand, multimodal networks, and on the other hand, multipolar but fluid collectives that need balance and equalization. That is, these are not homogeneous communities in lockstep. And indeed, they instead tend to view fixed hierarchies skeptically, especially when the latter resist attempts by these communities to control or reshape them. Such associations tend to develop both political and legal forms of a division of powers. What then are the realistic powers of the human spirit to which we genuinely have recourse within the weave of opportunities and crises? Let us begin this investigation with an assessment of the individual's mind and spirit. an assessment of early childhood, multimodal, and mental development. Western culture has long valued, especially, the intellectual faculties of the human spirit. The spirit has been understood primarily as the individual faculty of human thinking. In his splendid work, Sources of the Self, The Making of the Modern Identity, Charles Taylor has, beyond this intellectual spirit, illuminated the much richer multimodal powers of the mental spirit under the titles Inwardness and the Affirmation of Ordinary Life. He tries to understand the self in moral space and the role the voice of nature plays in the development of self and of modern identity. He emphasizes the importance of critically engaging with ideologies that place too much trust in the powers of the sciences or in the orienting powers of group morals. How can the human spirit develop optimally and avoid going astray? A grand philosophical tradition stands behind the intellectualist understanding of the human spirit that conceives the spirit first and foremost as thinking, ranging from the intellectual processing of sense perceptions to the activities of reason. Spirit as thinking, great topic. A key text can be found in Aristotle's Metaphysics, Book 12, where he describes how the intellectual activity of reason focuses on, grasps, and thinks about objects. In this very activity, however, reasoning thought, precisely by taking up objects into itself, it's also thinking itself. That is, thinking takes as its object not only external objects and in its surroundings, but also itself engaged in its own dynamic activity. Fantastic figure of thought. Here, thinking moves within a process of completion and intensification, and this activity of thinking is accompanied by both a sensibility and a striving, emphatic or not, for precisely such completion. That is, the subtler and richer perception of objects and surroundings moves thinking towards the completion of its conceptual powers, and the enhanced powers in their own turn deepen and expand its broader disclosure of the world. Wonderful observation. We develop our thinking in relation to our environment, to objects, the world. Then we get a richer picture of the world that has an impact on our thinking. We refine our thinking, and so we move up continuously, co-enhancing knowledge and world awareness. Aristotle refers to the highest intensification, that is, to the perfection of this process as divine, and ascribes it to the highest being. So you can also wonderfully include natural theology, the highest being as the divine, the world master in thinking. In early childhood development, we find a vivid illustration of the power of the nascent intellectual spirit and, beyond it, the wealth of the aesthetic and moral mind that accompanies the new life that Hannah Arendt celebrated with the term natality. A small child points for the first time to a nearby place or object and accompanies the gesture with the sound. Our child here will offer the sound in a minute. Da. Parents are naturally delighted at the first communication of their child in contact with its surroundings and world. After incessant repetitions of this action, they eventually tire of the sound that means da da da, look, look, look. They decide to instead to use the opportunity for a bit of teaching. That is a ball. Joy and delight erupt anew when the child does indeed seize on this new information. And again, once ball, ball, ball becomes fatiguing, the teaching begins anew. The ball is round. the ball is red. And again, great delight when one beholds language acquisition taking place before one's very eyes. The ascent to the cognitive and linguistic completion of the spirit to an expanded disclosure of the world can now begin in earnest. Later on, we insert not only a sentence, but a whole theory, you know, be it Kant or Paul or whatever, and so we enhance our capacity of knowledge and disclosure of the world. The human spirit, however, is intrinsically richer and more complex than what is usually conceived as a bipolar or best triadic completion of thought in the form of interplay between object relation and self-relation, the primitive form of which is simply subject-object, subject-object relationship. We can observe this complexity in what otherwise seemed to be the simplest didactic operation in early childhood. What is happening here? Immediate surroundings are disclosed. What, for example, has roused the child's interest? What natural or cultural spaces and objects are coming into focus? Even at this elementary level, the spirit engages in powerful aesthetic and intellectual operations. For the child, the concentrated perception, the selection from the profusion of optical impressions, is only one of many operations it must carry out and relate. This optical selection and concentration are joined by differentiated partial control of the body in form of a raised outstretched arm and a movement of a hand with an outstretched index finger. Optical, acoustic, tactile motor, and imaginative operations must all be coordinated. Under certain circumstances, the child abstracts from the sense of smell, already developed earlier, and from the sense of taste. It is astonishing to consider the complexity of the multimodal network and differentiation that must take place within the child's overstimulated body before the enormous operation of abstraction and psychosomatic synthesis can emerge in the form of an allegedly primitive deictic operation. Over the course of what Michael Tomasello calls the 9-month revolution, the internal complexity of multimodal sensuous reactions in the body is completed by similarly multimodal communication. Unfortunately, Tomasello speaks in a reductionistic fashion of a revolutionary transition from bipolar to triadic constellations, involving a further partner in the relation to the object of the environment. In fact, the relations are much more complex. The utterance look accompanying the gesture of pointing can draw attention to various primary interests. For example, to the child's affirmed object discovery, I see this again, to the elicitation of attention from others, look, and to what some scholars call the child's imperative anticipation of connecting response such as praise, reward, or the object itself being given to the child. At this level, the multimodal weave of physical perception is being joined by the formation of a rudimentary social milieu. In this sense, Tomasello and others say, pointing engaged on the basis of cooperative willingness and social intent introduces interactions characterized by divided attention focus. It is this divided attention focus that first makes language learning possible. It is also the basis for rudimentary moral communication. Moral communication, too, seems to commence quite straightforwardly. Parents approve and love, and the child behaves one way and speak harshly or even remains silent and behaves differently or inappropriately. At the level of linguistic communication, signals are given such as your mother will be so happy if you do this, or grandfather will be so sad when you don't do that. The child's sense of its current status is conditioned within a network in which attention is either granted or withheld, or promises or threats of such are issued. Rudimentary moral communication is accompanied by a variety of either deliberate or emergent educational processes. Thus, in order to grasp the multimodal power of the spirit with respect to the organization of human faculties, we must add communicative processes connected to deixis, to the weave of thinking, willing, and complex aesthetic perception of one's surroundings. Only then do we get an idea of its overwhelming capacities, even in the most basic embodied mental level. Most basic embodied mental level. It's enormously complex. The primary relational point and framework, however, consistently remains one's individual concrete physical existence, guided on the one hand by a multimodal sensuous network and on the other by socially interactive and linguistic mediated processes of communication and the radiance of natural and cultural surroundings. Beautifully illuminated by Augustine Fuentes' lecture. This mental spectrum of activity is also accompanied by a multifarious interest or drive toward completion. The disclosure of self in the world through the operations of feeling, thinking, and interacting also engaged with possibilities of both aesthetic and physical development. How can this multimodal power of the spirit be conceived in social, political, academic, and religious environments? Here, the young Hegel, a mastermind of the spirit, offers fruitful insights. So I come to my last part of this lecture, Religion and Spirit, the Fertile Natural Theology of the Young Hegel. We know that we still cannot say what is really going on in Hegel's thought. The last that was capable of uniting a theory of science, society, consciousness, and world. Although no one doubts its significance, its diagnosis is still outstanding. This 1971 assertion by Dieter Henrich, the leading German-speaking authority on German idealism, is still valid. It's interesting that we have theories that are like intellectual rainforests. And Hegel's mature theory belongs to that. Whitehead's process and reality lecture given here belong to this, where we only partially see what they are after. So, penetrating into the subtler depths of Hegel's excursions into thought, however, and into his demanding theory of the spirit becomes easier if we start with the early writings from Hegel's time as a tutor in Bern and in Frankfurt. We are talking about the time of 1793 to 1801. And I think we can shed a little more light on the depth of his thinking. And I will invite you to join me on that. For over a century, scholars hardly paid attention to these writings. And it was not until 1907 that they were published on the initiative of the philosopher Wilhelm Dilthey. Almost another century passed before an exemplary edition of these writings appeared in two volumes in 1989 and 2014. As part of Hegel's collected works, providing a reliable foundation for better understanding Hegel's early philosophical development, as late as 2014. With almost criminological acumen, editors used the changes of Hegel's handwriting and the watermarks of his manuscript papers in Bern and Frankfurt as a basis for dating with at least some reliability these texts that Hegel variously reworked over time and that were in part also quite fragmentary. It's an interesting scholarly project. On April 16, 1795, Hegel, 24 years old at the time, wrote to his friend Schelling in Bern, I quote, "Religion and politics have joined hands in the same underhanded game. The former has taught what despotism willed. Contempt for the human race, its incapacity for any good whatsoever, its incapacity to be something on its own," end of quote. Hegel expected the further development of the more recent philosophy of freedom by Kant and Fichte to prove the dignity of humankind in connection with which the anticipated two consequences. He anticipated two consequences. Again a quote, "The aura of prestige surrounding the heads of the oppressors and gods of this earth is disappearing. The philosophers are proving the dignity of men. The peoples will learn to feel it. Not only will they demand their rights, which have been trampled in the dust, they will take them back themselves, they will appropriate them." Over the following month in Bern, Hegel worked on a text that was not published until 1907 under the title The Life of Jesus. Hegel himself was apparently not particularly proud of this early piece, for in a letter on August 30th, 1795, to his admired friend Schelling, who was already publishing quite sophisticated speculative philosophical texts, he did not even mention these studies. And indeed, at first glance, Hegel's text seemed to be merely a gospel harmony in which he relates the life of Jesus in simple words, such the description given by the editors of the popular German paperback edition of his works in 20 volumes. So the most influential distribution of Hegel's thinking, 20 paperback volumes, and here the editor looked condescendingly on this early text. Those editors remark further that although this piece is certainly of significance as the only completely preserved work from Hegel's time in Bern, it is nonetheless of little significance for Hegel's philosophical development. Who cares about Jesus? An opinion prompting them not to include it in the paperback edition. So, unimaginable. Yeah, so that this early formative text that is relevant for a whole period in Hegel's life is just dismissed as little dealing with Jesus and biblical stuff, not important. Yet anyone who follows thoroughly the development of Hegel's early writings cannot but come to a quite different conclusion. In 1793, Kant's influential book, Religion Within the Limits of Reason Alone, had been published. Hegel had read this piece attentively and now incorporated Kant's findings into his own studies on the life of Jesus. Combining New Testament religiosity focused on Jesus with the more prominent philosophical ideas of his age in the field of ethics. Hegel maintains that considerable credit is due to Christ for his recognition of genuine morality and for his purer worship of God. So Hegel had not read, Jesus had not read Kant yet, but he has already the spirit. Jesus allegedly promoted reason's light, for it imposes morality as a matter of duty. Hegel praises Jesus praises reason's tribunal, which every person should approach through self-knowledge and extol the spirit of the rational word, which is nothing less than the spirit of divinity. The spirit of the rational word is the spirit of divinity. Reason and the law of reason, ethics, the law of ethics, duty, virtue, dignity, morality, and the inner law of freedom, Hegel's life of Jesus is replete with the ideas and terminology of Kant and of popular interpretations of Kant's ethics. Hegel emphasizes man's dignity and his capacity to derive from his own self the concept of divinity and the comprehension of the divine will was seen by Jesus. In this sense, Jesus' proclamation of the reign of God wholly corresponds to Kant's explication in his piece on religion. Jesus taught belief in the sacred law of our own reason and in the indwelling Holy Spirit of virtue. This text from Hegel's Sojourn in Bern is not simply a naive side note of his studies at the time. Even in his later studies and reworkings of texts from Bern during his time in Frankfurt, Hegel repeatedly returned to Jesus and his ministry, albeit with different focal points. Although he continued to follow the lofty speculative works of Fichte and Schelling, the great philosophers of the day, he now focused primarily on the variously radiating influence of religion on general morality and politics in the power of the spirit. His burning question was, how can a spirit of freedom be evoked and spread among people by philosophically and morally educated religion or by religiously informed philosophy? In his text, Positivity of the Christian Religion, dated September 24, 1800, he emphasizes the power of the Christian religion to shape different political considerations in history, and even to bridge social differences and tensions, appropriately observing that severely oppressed people and their overlords attended one church. Criticizing the enlightened critique of religion, Hegel insists that, I quote him, the conviction of many centuries, represented in dogmatic Christianity, regarded as sacrosanct, true and obligatory by the millions who lived and died by them in those centuries, were not, at least on their subjective side, downright folly or plain immorality. He sees it as the task of theologically sophisticated philosophy to disclose what exactly deserves to be called the divine spirit. Over against negative critiques of religion after the fashion of enlightenment, he remarks critically, I quote him again, if reason fixes its eyes on the transient elements alone and cries out about superstition of religion, then reason is to blame for setting to work superficially and overlooking the eternal. Despite his respect for metaphysical considerations of the relationship between the finite and the infinite among his friends and contemporaries, Hegel is not really interested simply in engaging in abstract metaphysics. His studies intend instead to enhance our discernment of the religious, moral, and political radiating presence of what he calls the spirit of life, a moral and political entity. That is, he intends to explore the religious and moral political presence of the spirit, a being, he says, which transcends our consciousness of human agency. The divine spirit should become the animating spirit of human life. In fragments from September 800, Hegel polemicizes against his philosophical colleagues and their inclination to turn the relationship between the finite and the infinite into a product of mere reflection. He similarly objects to Fichte's positing of an absolute I, that is, he says, a phenomenon of the time, at bottom equivalent to the phenomenon of dependence on an absolute alien being which cannot become man. So he says, abstract theism, a God that cannot become incarnate, estranging. Abstract subjectivity, Fichte's great modern program, similarly far away. So he sees that both old style metaphysics and modern style theory of subjectivity have similar problems. A metaphysical theology of a transcendent God must be rejected, but also a speculative philosophy of the absolute I or the absolute subject. Both forms are equally alienating and present no path of freedom and elevation. Hegel understands spirit as the living unity of the manifold, and he finds the spirit at work as a living unity of multiplicity and moral and political arrangements based on freedom, and is keenly interested in the conflicts such entities have with oppressive religious and political powers. The spirit is a living, integrated power within human subjectivity and the latter's varied mental faculties, as well as within the religious, moral, and political spheres of life. As such, the spirit manifests itself in various forms amid ever-changing cultural and historical surroundings. Although Hegel's understanding of the spirit acquires considerable sophistication and architectural beauty in his mature philosophy, it also suffers severe losses. In Jena, Hegel would go on to publish the Phenomenology of Spirit, masterpiece. He would clarify differences between his own philosophy and that of leading philosophers of his age. And finally, he would also enter into the competition to optimize the study of transcendental philosophy and metaphysics. Even then, however, continuity with his early ideas and visions is clearly discernible, and that makes his position so complicated. Yeah, so he has two lines, the early Hegel with a much more mobile spirit, and then the mature Hegel, much more streamlined form. For Hegel's later development continued to be shaped by an understanding of the spirit influenced by distinctly Christian religiosity, by a reflection on the connective powers of religion, politics, and philosophy in their reactionary, in their liberal, and in their revolutionary forms, and by a consciousness of the cultural and historical polymorphism of the spirit. Hegel's understanding of spirit, however, became problematic when he integrated metaphysical and totalizing figures and forms of thought into his philosophy. On this basis, right-wing Hegelians and others praised this philosopher of the Weltgeist, admirer of Aristotle, and defender of classical metaphysics, and even attributed to him an interest in a cosmic spirit, as did Charles Taylor in his otherwise extremely powerful and beautiful Hegel book. Left-wing Hegelians, Feuerbach, Ruge, Moses Hess, Friedrich Engels, Karl Marx, who had welcomed Hegel's youthful passion for freedom, could not go along with this development because it threatened the spirit of freedom in society. They regarded the older Hegel as a servant of an authoritarian state, a state that he even saw as the manifest God. So two quotes from his philosophy of right. The state consists in the march of God in the world. Or we should therefore venerate the state as an earthly divinity. It is the early dynamics in Hegel's thinking that provide the proper lens through which to perceive and appreciate the richness of his theory of the spirit and its fruitful impulses, even for today. His expensive lectures on the philosophy of religion, the philosophy of history, the history of philosophy, on aesthetics, and the basic outlines of the philosophy of law, all richly attest this consistent focus on a multimodal spirit. Operative not only in human minds, but also in a multitude of historical and cultural environments. In the following lectures, I will explore how divine and human multimodal spirits gain contours in their work for justice, for freedom, for truth, and for peace. They constitute powerful counterforces against the human misery, self-endangerment, and brutality addressed in the first of my lectures on the image of God. The realistic spirit of justice, freedom, truth, and peace will be our multimodal topic in natural theology. Thank you very much. So the young Hegel, another PowerPoint I did not put in on time.
Engaging, a theme of profound importance, showing the way out of the rather dark vision that we had in our first lecture. Professor Welke will continue his Gifford series, just to remind you, here on Thursday evening at the same time of 5:30, and we look forward to that next lecture entitled Called to Justice. Let me also point out that we're holding an online discussion throughout the fortnight of our series on the Gifford Lectures blog, which is led by Mr. Andrew Johnson of New College. To follow and contribute to that discussion, visit the address at the back of the leaflet and on our Gifford Lectures web pages. Let me also remind you of the seminar. Everyone is warmly invited to attend the Gifford seminar, which is going to be held on Wednesday, the 6th of November, from 11 a.m. to 12:15 p.m. in the Martin Hall of New College on Mound Place. Professor Welke will be joined by Dr. Sarah Lane Ritchie and Dr. Joshua Ralston on a panel, which will be chaired by Dr. Alison Elliott, General Secretary of the Royal Society of Edinburgh, to discuss questions and comments from the audience arising from the Gifford series. I may open then with a historian's question, if you don't mind. I found the discussion of the young Hegel fascinating, and trying to, as he's developing I think you were saying a multimodal idea of the spirit, and he's doing so in the 1790s as the period of the French Revolution, the upheavals of the French Revolution, the promise, the hope of the French Revolution, the democracy, the common people having a voice, in a sense creating a much more multimodal society in France and the promise of that across Europe. And I just wondered to what extent Hegel may have been influenced by these larger environmental forces.
Of course. Yes. Hegel was a student in Tübingen together with Schelling and Hölderlin, famous group, and they celebrated the French Revolution and had the feeling we have to work for the coming of the reign of God, as a political reign of God also, and they had the idea that they could help to bring together classic religious impulses and modern philosophical impulses of freedom. And they were very critical of their teachers and theology, and they hated them when they brought in Kant in order to protect the orthodox positions. And what Hegel tries to develop is an alternative here. And of course, for many philosophers, he looks naive in his studies. Yeah, so Fichte and Schelling, they develop already wonderful speculative theories, and here's the little naive Hegel who goes through the biblical stuff and tries to bring in Kant into Jesus' head and mind. And but it is not at all. He really brings together two types of thinking, but with an interest. He wants to activate the spirit.
Because the society in France is becoming much more multimodal if we think in terms of common people who didn't have a voice before. Yeah. They now do have a voice. Yeah. But in some senses, it's also becoming streamlined as that voice, this multiplicity of voices are increasingly becoming a nation. And the idea of the nation having a spirit as well.
Yes. Well, and you see it in Hegel, this his fascination by the Berlin political leadership and the Berlin court and so on. But already earlier, when he he writes the phenomenology of spirit, we have the feeling the positions he objected, yeah, the God out there and the subject out there, then are fused because he wants to integrate Spinozian, Spinozist, Spinozist positions and Fichte's position. And then you see the message of Christianity is the substance becomes subject. Yeah. And suddenly you have, Hegel brings it in. He still says, well, we have to stick to the sophistications of the religious traditions. But then he develops this complicated, as Henry says, difficult position we cannot really decode, because he brings in old-style metaphysics, new-style absolutist theory of subjectivity, and tries to fuse it with these impulses.
Hegel had a good deal to say about art in all its forms as an expression and realization of spirit. Is that going to play an important role in your multimodal account of spirit for us today?
Well, I think it should. I think that Hegel has an enormous amount of resources, also with his philosophy of history. And we, and I include myself, I've written a doctoral dissertation on Hegel, Hegel's phenomenology. We were so fascinated by the grand architecture, you know, the grandiose architecture of Hegel, that we did not look into these details. But I take your point as it would be a wonderful re-examination of his philosophy of art in this light. Yeah, so I think we still have some way to go to see the polyphonic Hegel more clearly.
Dr. Rosten.
Thank you very much again for the lecture. I was wondering if you could tease out a little bit of maybe a tension or a misunderstanding that I had. And you start with this sort of calling down of the spirit, and you end with sort of the enlightened philosopher or the theologically astute religious scholar. But then in the middle, you have this account of the child and of development.
Yeah.
And I'm just wondering, the calling down of the spirit implies sort of a hierarchy. How do you make sense of your claim yesterday about a bottom-up account and child, especially if we think of revolutionary moments that may exist not from the calling down of a pope, but of the protest of people calling for justice and freedom? I mean, I don't think it contradicts what you're saying, but could you say a little bit more about the tension between authority and hierarchy and bottom-up?
Well, the structure of my lecture was first, of course, the divine spirit, then the human spirit, and the combination of both in sophisticated constellations. And I think that John Paul's position is sophisticated because, of course, he speaks of God's answer, but it's also the summons of the people. Here you have, and I found it attractive for a natural theology perspective, that you here want to, that he wants to activate his fellow poles for social transformation, very much bottom up. Yeah. On the other hand, when I did my, when I wrote my book on the spirit, I was very much interested in the relation of law and spirit, the biblical law traditions and the spirit traditions, and I became fascinated by this figure of the pouring, yeah? Because the pouring of the spirit is this multiple impulse, and it has with the strange and patriarchal societies, gerontocratic societies, the pouring of the spirit coming down on women and slaves, yeah? And young people, and then in the New Testament, even having an impact on the different nations in a very tribe-oriented mindset, I found this very, very interesting. And this figure of thinking also exploding bipolar and monistic forms of thought. And so in a way, I used this. It's interesting. I was invited to give the John Paul II Memorial Lecture in Warsaw. and I was very reluctant to accept, because I had not the smoothest relation. I admire what he did, but I experienced his presence as Pope in Tübingen. I always had 8 to 10 Catholic students in my seminars. John Paul II and Ratzinger came. I had one, and the second semester, none. And my Italian friends, publishers, who were very ecumenical, said they broke our neck, and they, as Italians, they opened up a travel agency and stopped publishing. So I had a little complicated relation. So when they invited me, I said first no, then they insisted, then I said, okay, then I want to speak on God's spirit and human freedom. Okay, you can do this. So I worked on his magnificent encyclica, Dominus et Vivificantem, and said it's a bright, it's a modernist spirit that he has here, and so. So we come to Warsaw, Ulrike and I, a sociologist picks up us up, leads us to the place where Willy Brandt knelt down, and then to the place where John Paul, as the Pope, had given this lecture, this invocation. And I was struck. I said, well, not in the encyclical, but here it's exactly the theology, I think, that is so important. And then I rewrote my introduction, and we were bathed in the warmth of our Polish friends and our Catholic friends. A week later, I got a letter, we cannot publish this. It was too revolutionary. And so it was a gift for me to bring it in these lectures, because it opened my eyes to a wonderful revolutionary form where you bring in theology top-down and a bottom-up movement. And then I invested it to illuminate. And with early childhood development, it was a recent work. I was a transcendental thinker, of course, for a long time in my life, and only on the Aristotelian transcendental line. And we engaged very much in embodied cognition, and I had to learn. One of your colleagues, who cannot be here today, but we sent her the lecture. She had urgent other duties. She works on these areas, and I became convinced, and I found this fascinating, the multimodal spirit of a little child already with the most simple mental operation. This enormous richness of the spirit in our mind from the very beginning. And so it's this interest in this complexity of the working of the spirit in religious, in mental, not just intellectual, but intellect included, of course, mental, and then in the multiplicity of relations that the young Hegel tried to shoulder, religion, politics, and the interaction, and public education, and so on and so on.
Thank you very much. As someone from a medical background, I was quite fascinated with you bringing in this aspect of child, the baby developing, and in pediatric terminology, we have what we call development windows of learning, and smell being very primordial instinct, and then eating and relationality get at this different stage of learning. Is there a notion that our ability to accept an outpouring of a spirit is a plastic developmental window which can be affected by extraneous events of the time? Yeah. And we see a lot of this biblical and through revolution, ideological, and not only at the population levels is this outpouring of the spirit affected, but any one individual, I anticipate, through an effect on the adjustment of your window of learning for acceptance of the spirit and acceptance of political. How does that sit with your theology, because you've taken it from a very population-based, I'm trying to take it in from the multimodal learning aspect and development of human personality, because the human being, when we get to 25, we're no longer a developing human brain. Yeah. And is there any notion that if we have adverse experience, will we always be affected in receiving the spirit?
Well, I think with this approach that I'm proposing, we are opening avenues of research that are just breathtaking. One was the impulse, we just got aesthetics. Yeah. This helps you to explore in a new way the working of the spirit and aesthetics with the help of Hegel. Then we might say, okay, this is helpful, this is maybe not so helpful, but these are powerful new windows. And what you say with learning and bringing in new impulses, you spoke about senses that I did not include with the deixis because they are so hard to control. Smell, I learned that human beings can discern 10,000 types of smell. 10,000. I think without digital help, we will not be able to move into these areas. But of course, you can then see how different cultures and different ways of nourishment and different environments and so on have impacts on the human mind and the human development.
Yes, I'm
a retired minister, and I'm looking back on my theological education some 60 years ago. We had courses on philosophy, and one of them I remember was entitled The Long Shadow of Kant. Yeah. Does Kant still cast a long shadow?
Yeah. I would say yes. I think Kant still is a very, very important classic, but of course people are today more flirting with Nietzsche. Yeah, the intellectuals are more flirting with a more skeptical approach toward the human mind and cultural settings. But I think that Kant is like Plato or Aristotle, one of the great classics that will continue not only to have long shadows, but also long shedding of light.
Oh, sorry, I didn't have the microphone. Thank you. Sorry, I sort of a very basic question, if I may, just to add, help me clarify some of the things that you were saying. You spoke a lot, obviously, about the notion of sort of freedom. And I think for many of us, the notion of freedom has been sort of shaped by the sort of political discussion that we've had in these lands and these universities associated with the names of people like Isaiah Berlin and Karl Popper, where one makes a distinction between negative freedom, the absence of constraint, and positive freedom, being liberated to be what you are. And truly are, in which case you can force someone to be free, force them to become what they should be. Now, as I was listening to your lecture, I had a feeling, and this will reveal my own misunderstanding, that in your first lecture, it was the former, the negative sense of freedom, the absence of constraint that was dominating the discussion. Whereas in the second one, with the strong emphasis on Hegel, it was this positive sense of freedom, the where you can force someone to be free and be what they were. Of course, the exception in the second lecture was the example you gave of Pope John Paul, where, if you like, he was freeing people from a totalitarian regime. Yeah. But I just wonder, I mean, as I heard the lectures, it was the negative sense of freedom was playing a large part in the first lecture, and the positive sense in the second. Was I mishearing?
No, not at all. But I will say more on the topic of freedom next Monday. Then it will be So a notion of freedom. And as you can predict already, it will be a multimodal concept of freedom where you have different elements of. So my point is, Hegel had this nice saying, was ein Prinzip ist, ein bloßes Prinzip, taugt eben deshalb nichts. What is a mere principle is not worth it, because it's merely a principle. And he had this nice saying, he said, a principle includes everything, but it only includes everything like a thrifty person who keeps all the money in his purse and saves himself or herself from the hardship of enjoyment. And so it was the mere principle doesn't work. And so I think when we try to get the spirit with a mere principle, we are on the wrong path. Yeah. So the spirit, an inspiring spirit, is not a mere principle. We need principles, of course, for our orientation, and in my lecture on truth, it will play an important role. But I think that Hegel's genius is that he has a richer perspective from early on with the notion of the spirit.
Mark, we have a question in the front over here. Yes.
Hello, thank you again for a really interesting lecture. I'm thinking about maybe the psychology of the divine spirit, and if we were present with the idea of God or the divine spirit within ourselves, could it minimize subjective suffering? Like just having the thought of this within us? Like I'm thinking about...
I didn't get your question.
Sorry. So can being present with the divine spirit or the concept of God minimize subjective suffering? I'm thinking about maybe Alexander Solzhenitsyn's The Gulag Archipelago, where he said people living in dire conditions through the belief in God and the divine will of God, they were able to get through these circumstances and made it out. So I'm kind of thinking, is that something we have to think about in our contemporary world?
Yeah. Well, I think that we have notions of God that are freeing and helpful, but we also have notions of God that suppress people. And or very often we have, I think that in our culture we have, I call this wrong optimizations of the understanding of God. Abstract theism, God determines everything, and people say, well, the theologians and the philosophers have to say this, but I don't believe it. Yeah. Does he also create concentration camps, or does he also determine what kind of bottom I have here on my shirt? So people have, against this totalitarian abstract notion of dominion, grand reserves. And the other false optimization is what I call the me and my inner other, God. Yeah, so zoom into yourself and you will discover God. And so I think that it's very important what kind of piety, what kind of religion you have. And I want to propose in this lecture that concentrating on the spirit, human and divine, will help us to discover dimensions in the creativity of God. Yeah. Since I'm a theologian of revelation, yeah, I have to put my tongue in cheek and not going into more Christological forms. David Kelsey has written a wonderful anthropology where he can make all this use to that, of that. But I also think that this discipline of natural theology is healthy. Yeah, because we can, sometimes when we go too quickly into biblical imagery, we then depart on an enthusiasm that other people cannot share. But I think that you're right, there are many, many impulses in relating to God, to the divine, that can have very freeing and healing consequences. But they are also different with different people, multimodal.
I think we'll have to draw the discussion to a close. We have been going for considerably more than the 25 minutes. I'm sure we could go for longer still, but we've been working our speaker very hard. But first, I would like to thank the audience for your participation, including your valuable questions. I think the commitment and the loyalty and the diverse interests of our Gifford audiences have really been vital to the success of the series for over 100 years. And next, it's a great pleasure just to express our appreciation again to Professor Welker for an important lecture, which he called us to a multipolar understanding and multimodal understanding of both the human and the divine spirit in a search for a capacity to transcend those darker forces of political manipulation and ideologies of hatred that he looked at in his first lecture. I think we had a fascinating kind of juxtaposition of the development of the child and the development of modern societies in a pluralistic, multimodal manner, which will also be inclusive and respect for diversity. And finally, let me remind everyone that Professor Welker will continue his series here in the Playfair Library on Thursday evening, same time of 5:30 p.m., and we look forward to the next lecture entitled Called to Justice. But could you join me again in thanking our speaker and the questioners in the audience?